It is my great, great privilege to introduce to you Justice Sandra Day O'Connor.
Well, that was quite an introduction that we just heard. And Justice Breyer, she's all right. She's good, too. And Katie is just marvelous. I hope many of you have had the privilege of meeting Katie. She's pretty grown up now. But what a wonderful girl she is, and what a wonderful youngster she was. And thank you so much, President Sexton, for your introduction. And John Sexton's work as an educator, both here at NYU and through all of his other activities, like the Urban Debate League, has set a very high bar for individual commitment to civics education. And I want to thank you, Dean Revesz, and the law school for hosting this event. I remember Dean Revesz when he was a law clerk for Justice Thurgood Marshall. Looked a little younger in those days, I think. And John Sexton mentioned some of the events that have been held here. And for several years, members of our court met with members of Russia's Constitutional Court. And we got to this stage where we really could communicate with some of them pretty well. And I remember lots of meetings. Now that's kind of stopped. And I think you better see about that, because we're becoming strangers with the Russian Federation. It's a tougher relationship. And whether they would entertain the possibility of restoring some of those meetings, I don't know, but I think it's worth exploring. We certainly had some good meetings here. And thanks so much to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences distinguished group. It recently made me a member, so I'm paying a lot of attention. And you probably know that John Adams helped found the Academy of Arts and Sciences. And at the time that he did that, he was also trying to write a constitution for the state of Massachusetts. And it has some pretty forceful language about the importance of judicial independence. That Massachusetts constitution, thanks to John Adams, says, "It is essential to the preservation of the rights of every individual to be tried by judges as free, impartial, and independent as the lot of humanity will admit." So what did John Adams have in mind when he referenced an independent judiciary more than two centuries ago? Back when the notion of a judiciary with power to secure and protect certain fundamental rights was a pretty radical idea. Judicial independence as a concept doesn't lend itself to very precise definition. And maybe the easiest way to understand it is to look at settings where it did not exist. Now, I grew up in the Southwest, was born in El Paso, went to school there. And in the late 1800s, Judge Roy Bean ran his courthouse out of a saloon in West Texas, not too far from the Lazy Bee Ranch. And everyone on Roy Bean's court, from defendants to jurors to lawyers, was expected to buy drinks during each one of his frequent recesses. And if you didn't buy a drink, the judge would hold you in contempt of court, and you would be fined the cost of a drink. Now, the saloon turned courthouse had a big sign in front of it that read, "Law, West of the Pecos." And just above that sign was another sign that read, "Ice cold beer." Now, I would have hoped, at the very least, that the law would have gotten top billing on the marquee, but it didn't. He was selling ice cold beer and law in that order. In one typical case, Judge Bean sentenced a young man to hang, only to discover later that the man had over $400 in a bank account. And when Judge Bean learned that, he sensed that there might be some profit here in leniency. And the judge said, by gobs, we've made a mistake. This man does not deserve to hang. Well, now, in one sense, you could say that Judge Bean was independent. He did whatever he liked, and often he was guided purely by monetary concerns. But that's not what I mean when I talk about judicial independence, and I don't think it's what John Adams had in mind either. I mean somebody, a judge, who's constrained by what the law says and requires, and a judge who's independent from external influences. Of course, a judiciary that's subject to strong external influences is not just a thing of the distant past. We've seen evidence of that all around the globe. And while our federal judges in this country receive appointments for good behavior, a significant percentage of our state court judges are elected for a term of years, and they're elected in partisan campaigns quite often, and those campaigns have become increasingly expensive and unwieldy and nasty. And such destructive campaigns, I think, erodes the public's perception of the judiciary, because it's difficult to believe that judges can remain neutral when they have to so often think about the popularity of their opinions and who it was that donated to their campaigns. You hear horror stories of lawyers going to trial in Texas, which is one of those states that has elections like that. And the first thing you do is go check and see if you can find out how much the lawyers on the other side have already given to the judge. And if you can find that out, then you have to match it or exceed it, or you don't go to trial. Now, what kind of a system is that? And why do we want to tolerate that kind of thing in our country? I don't know. It isn't difficult to see how corrupting that money injected into these campaigns can become. After being elected to the Illinois Supreme Court in 2004, after a judicial election where the candidates spent more than $9 million combined, think of it. Justice Lloyd Carmeier asked, how can people have faith in the system when such obscene amounts of money are used to influence the outcome of the elections? And he was the one who won the race. Now, you can only imagine what the losing candidate might have said afterward. Probably nothing we would want to repeat in public. Or consider the Massey Coal case from West Virginia, where the justice who cast the deciding vote to overturn a $50 million verdict against Massey Coal Company had received more than $3 million in the campaign contributions from the company's owner while the appeal was pending in the court. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court is currently looking, I believe, at a cert petition in that case, which raises the question of whether at some point the Due Process Clause requires a judge to recuse himself or herself, where the perception of bias is so strong. Now, I don't think that a litigant giving a $3 million contribution to a judicial candidate's campaign is what John Adams had in mind when he envisioned judges who were as impartial and independent as the will of humanity would admit. We can do better than that in this country. And thanks to some of you who are in the social sciences, there's a growing body of empirical research that demonstrate how these campaign contributions and judges' fear of reprisal for making unpopular decisions do, in fact, have an effect on judicial decision-making. I encourage those of you in the social sciences to continue collecting and reviewing the empirical data that demonstrates the effects that campaigns like that have on the judiciary. Now, the judiciary's authority and legitimacy rests really on the public trust and the agreement of the public in general to abide by rulings of the courts. And we can't afford to have a judicial system that is perceived as being corrupt, biased, or otherwise unethical. And the judges, after all, don't have any real means of enforcing most of their rulings. Our gavels aren't that big, and we can't swing them that hard. Now, our courts rely on the other branches of government and to the public to follow and acquiesce in the rulings made by the courts. And it's somewhat amazing how the other branches of government normally through the years have abided by and enforced court rulings, whether it was President Eisenhower, who sent the 101st Airborne to Little Rock, Arkansas, to ensure that the schools were integrated after Brown versus Board of Education and Cooper versus Aaron, or whether it was President Nixon, who sealed his own fate and turned over incriminating tapes and documents in response to the Supreme Court's decision in U.S. versus Nixon. And while we've been fortunate to have a judicial system that's generally respected, it should not be taken for granted, and we mustn't do that. I think statutes and constitutions don't protect judicial independence. People do. And while we're not at the stage where protesters might overrun the Supreme Court building like they did in the country of Zimbabwe not too long ago, the time to address concerns that I've described tonight is before those concerns become so large we can't solve them. And I think that time is now. I hope we can help educate all Americans in this country on what we mean by judicial independence, and particularly explain why it matters, because it does. And I'm hoping that in time we can persuade some of the states that still hold partisan elections to develop a somewhat better form of judicial selection, similar to that which our esteemed framers of our Constitution developed when they met in Philadelphia so long ago. Well, thanks for being here tonight, and I think we have quite a panel up here. Why don't we get them all up here and see what we're going to talk about, okay?